You're listening to The 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. As long as there have been presidents of the United States, there have been presidents complaining about their coverage in the press. While we don't have tape of James K. Polk or Grover Cleveland, it has been a regular feature of politics since the dawn of electronic media.
Motion picture cameras join newspaper reporters in the old State Department building for an historic presidential press conference, the first ever filmed in sound by newsreel cameramen. More than 200 correspondents are crowded in the chamber as the president strides briskly in to face the press and the cameras.
Well, I see we're trying a new experiment this morning. I hope it doesn't prove to be a disturbing influence. I have no announcements. We'll go directly to questions.
I have never heard or seen such outrageous, vicious, distorted reporting in 27 years of public life.
So how but can
so,
you
so, this, so the notion,
you guarantee so, that they're not going to they're going to be able me, to keep their doctor?
Brad, you got
to
let me finish my answers.
But sir, I know you don't like the filibuster.
I'm trying to answer your questions, and you keep on interrupting. So let me be clear.
Since you're attacking us, can you give us a question? Mr. President-elect.
Go ahead.
Mr. President-elect,
go ahead.
Since you are attacking our news organization, can you give us a chance?
Your organization is
You are attacking
terrible.
Our news organization.
Your organization
can you give us
terrible.
A chance
Let's
to
go.
Ask a question, sir?
Can I'm you, not going to give you a
can
question.
You can you state categorically?
You are fake news.
Sir,
go ahead.
Can you state categorically that nobody... No, Mr. President-elect...
While the story continues today, many commentators say President Trump is different. Quote, the First Amendment lawyer Floyd Abrams says Trump easily surpasses Richard Nixon as the greatest threat the news media in America has ever faced, unquote. That subhead was from The Atlantic magazine in 2018, but our guest today says President Trump is not the first to take issue with his coverage. Harold Holzer has written, co-written, or edited dozens of books on history, many about Abraham Lincoln. His latest is The Presidents Versus the Press, the endless battle between the White House and the media, from the Founding Fathers to fake news. Harold Holzer, welcome to The 21st. Thanks for being with us today. Oh, and we are conducting this interview over Zoom. You might have your Zoom muted there.
How is that?
Isn't that is much better.
I'm sorry. I was just complimenting you. I'll happily repeat the compliment.
Oh,
what
I'll
a great
it.
Collection of sound bites that was. Loved
well,
it.
Thank you. Yeah, there's a rich archive to delve into, at least for the last 60 years or so.
Right.
Listeners, we want to invite you to join our conversation. The number is 800-222-9455. Once again, the number 800-222-9455. Do you think President Trump is unique in his attacks on the press? Or do you see him, as our guest today does, as part of a continuum? Maybe we will convince you of that as we discuss. Give us a call, 800-222-9455. You can also always tweet us at 21st Show. So I want to begin. Your book is structured chronologically, and I want to begin. But I want to begin with the introduction, where you talk about a tantrum by a president. I'm not naming him yet, but
right.
This president was outraged at the latest indignity at the hands of the press. In this case, it was an unflattering political cartoon. One of his cabinet secretaries later recalled the president saying he'd rather be dead than living through what he was dealing with. Who was this petulant president?
Very alliterative. The petulant president was George Washington. And he proceeded to throw the newspaper to the floor and jump up and down on it with his heavy boots, much to the amusement of Thomas Jefferson, who wrote that observation. Although it was Jefferson, interestingly, who had imported the first anti-George Washington newspaper to work in the Capitol to undermine public confidence in Washington. And not only begged this journalist to come from New York to Philadelphia, but gave him a job in the State Department as a translator to sort of subvent his enterprise. An extraordinary moment showing how important the press was even at the dawn of the Republic, for sure.
You know, in another thing you write about Washington is we often think today of his decision to serve only two terms.
Right.
Is establishing a sort of what the Cincinnatus-like precedent for the office, right? It's one of the measures of
yes.
his greatness. But you find that he may have had other motives for his retirement.
Yeah, I think, sure, the Cincinnatus imperative was strong. That is, return to the farm, don't do a monarchy. But in the draft of his famous farewell address, a paragraph that didn't make the final cut made it clear, as he put it, that the gazettes of the United States have teemed with invective, disappointment, ignorance of fact, misrepresenting his politics, wounding his reputation. And I think it's pretty clear that he was getting out because 5 years of his eight had been characterized by brutal criticism, not only political, but personal. You know, saying that some anti-federalist papers were alleging that he had that he'd stuffed his expense accounts, that he'd marched out of Washington illegal, not out of Washington, out of Philadelphia illegally to put down the Whiskey Rebellion, that he had behaved badly in his military career. I mean, this was really wounding to someone who generally was not used to any kind of criticism, much less this kind of invective.
And it's interesting, we think of him today, you know, him, he's represented literally by an obelisk in Washington, is this stoic, solid presence. But he was so thin-skinned, you talk about.
But you know, there's a, by the way, last time I looked, he was represented by an obelisk. That's another conversation entirely. I hope it stays there, but it's becoming as controversial in some quarters as Confederate monuments. Yeah, he was thin-skinned. I mean, again, unused to criticism. Adams was thin-skinned and did much more than Donald Trump to crack down against dissent. Lincoln was not thin-skinned particularly. He himself once said that he had never been in a political campaign where he that was not characterized by huge amounts of abuse, and that he'd never been quite free of ridicule in his entire life. He said it rather sadly. And yet Lincoln is still the all-time champion for shutting down newspapers and imprisoning editors, belligerent anti-Lincoln editors.
Yeah, and I want to dwell on Lincoln a little, because since this is an Illinois show, and we are broadcasting out of Central Illinois, we do need to take a break in about 3 minutes. So I just want to warn you, we'll have to interrupt here in a moment. But I want to begin with this idea of sort of what was the press like, right? Some years ago, I worked for the State Journal Register newspaper in Springfield, which is a successor to the Sangamo Journal. And there was a quote on the wall of outside the newsroom. It said, from Lincoln, "The Journal paper was always my friend, and of course its editors the same," unquote. I mean, I can't imagine modern newsrooms doing something like that for a contemporary politician. I mean, even Fox News is not going to have a compliment from President Trump on the wall. So what was the American press like at the time of the Civil War?
Completely aligned with political parties. So the Journal started as a Whig paper. It became a Republican paper. It was always for Lincoln. Lincoln hung out there. He was in the office of the Journal when news of his nomination came to Springfield from Chicago. They were collaborators in the Whig and Republican causes. But just to make sure that our listeners know, and of course you know, that even though the names of the papers are commingled today on the masthead, the Register was always Lincoln's enemy. Its editors were his enemies. They were Stephen Douglas men. They ridiculed and attacked Lincoln both when he was a Whig and when he was a Republican. They were a thorn in his side. But that was open partisan journalism, happily practiced, openly practiced, accepted that even the news pages were going to be partisan. If we have another second, after the first Lincoln-Douglas debate in Ottawa, the Journal wrote that Lincoln was so triumphant that his supporters carried him off on their shoulders. The Register wrote, Lincoln was so exhausted that his supporters had to carry him off on their shoulders. That's typical political news coverage in Democratic versus Republican papers in 1858.
You could read the same report in different papers and get very sort of Rashomon-like understandings of what's happening there.
Exactly.
Yeah. So we're going to come back to Lincoln, who, as you know, we've established a very political press. Some newspapers, he was welcomed to Washington with one paper you write about calling him the Illinois ape. So he had good reason to dislike the press, and we're going to talk about that when we return. We are speaking with Harold Holzer, a historian whose new book is called The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media from the Founding Fathers to Fake News. More to come after a short break. You're listening to The 21st. Stay with us. Welcome back to the 21st. I'm Brian Mackey. We're speaking with historian Harold Holzer, who has written many books of history, many about Abraham Lincoln. His latest book is The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media, From the Founding Fathers to Fake News. Listeners, you're always welcome to join our conversation. The number is 800-222-9455. That's 800-222-9455. Before the break, we were talking about Lincoln. He certainly took a lot of vitriol from quarters of the press, and he responded in kind. You call him the harshest and most repressive presidential censor yet. You have a quote in the book, you say, or I should say, quoting from the book, quote, "Even John Adams' Sedition Act prosecutions could not match for ferocity and scope the undeclared, unlegislated, unlitigated, and largely unchallenged war the Lincoln administration began waging against hostile domestic newspapers within months of his inauguration." What form did this war take?
So after the Battle of Bull Run, which the Union lost against all expectations, dangerously, the Union Army's first 90 and 100-day volunteers were really out of time. They had to re-up, re-enlist, or the Union Army was going to have no soldiers. When Democratic newspapers in the North began editorializing that the soldiers should maybe not re-enlist, the Lincoln administration moved in, and as far north as New York, New Hampshire, Maine even, closed down the newspapers that had recommended staying out of the army, basically. Took the newspapers from post offices, threw them off trains. The State Department, the War Department, the Post Office Department all cracked out, and so did the army itself. Editors, one of whom was dragged from his bed in New York and summoned to Washington for a kind of inquisition, were put in military prisons. And this had happened even earlier when the border states like Maryland and Missouri and Kentucky teetered on the brink of secession. Lincoln wanted to stop secession there at all costs. So here's an example. In Baltimore, a Democratic editor rails against the Union Army. The military moves in, arrests the editor. His name is Francis Key Howard. And they put Howard without a trial in Fort McHenry. Now, that's the famous fort in Baltimore Harbor where the Star-Spangled Banner had flown during a bombardment in the War of 1812, inspiring Francis Scott Key to write the national anthem. Well, John Howard was Francis Scott Key's grandson, and that did not stop him from getting a view of Fort McHenry from the inside looking out, as opposed to what his grandfather saw.
Yeah. Well said. So I have to ask, I mean, that's one anecdote among many. We are broadcasting from Central Illinois, where, of course, you know, Washington the Father, Lincoln the Savior, the 16th president is rightly a secular saint around here. But I have to ask on the question of press freedom, how do you rank Presidents Trump and Lincoln?
I don't like mentioning them in the same breath, but I guess we have to for purposes of this discussion. So the honest answer is that Trump is all bark and no bite. It's not inconsistent with the way he conducts himself on other issues, if I can editorialize a little. I think he treats the press sort of like the coronavirus. He realizes it's an impediment, but he's not organized enough to do anything. So it's a lot of complaint, a lot of vicious rhetoric, and a man I admire so much, whom you quoted at the outset, the great First Amendment lawyer, Floyd Abrams, thinks that the corrosive drip, drip, drip of the criticism is damaging. But so many pillars of the Republic are losing the confidence of the American people, the military, the courts, the post office, the presidency, the Congress, and journalism. It's going to take a lot to agree on objective truth again. Because the fact is, in the last 20 years, we have re-entered, at least on broadcast television, an era of openly partisan journalism. Well, I wouldn't say openly. It's open enough to the viewers. MSNBC and Fox News do not announce their political orientation. They both claim to be communicating objective truth. The fact is, they're closely allied with each of them, respectively, with the principles of the major parties. They just don't admit it as they did in the 19th century. So I think we've come full cycle in a way back to politically oriented broadcast journalism. And in this case, the president of the United States is chipping away at confidence in either pro-democratic or pro-Republican communications platforms. I mean, he's not very nice to Fox News either when they dare to say anything critical or just observe him straightforwardly.
Right. So I want to draw another parallel that I think you draw out in your book here, which is the use of electronic media, which obviously President Trump has done so well on Twitter, but this is also not a news story. We have one other clip here. This is FDR, who is taking advantage of the growing mass medium of radio.
My friend, I want to talk for a few minutes with the people of the United States about banking. And I know that when you understand what we in Washington have been about, I shall continue to have your cooperation as fully as I have had your sympathy and your help during the past week.
So as long as I've been alive, certainly we've seen presidents wanting to get around this, you know, the so-called filter of the media, right?
Right.
Do you draw a connection between the fireside chats and at real Donald Trump?
I do, and that's the other thread, I think, in the book, is that the presidents who have found a way to get around the press and communicate directly to the people with new technologies have been the most successful communicators. And FDR had three things going for him. First, he was extraordinarily accessible, 998 news conferences in 12 years. Second, he was friendly and congenial to the press. And as a result, they generally hid the extent of his disability from polio. There was just a gentleman's agreement in the first 6 or 7 years of his administration, later enforced by the press office, but just a gentleman's agreement not to photograph him in his wheelchair, not to photograph him being lifted in and out of his automobiles like a doll. And that's an extraordinary hold he held over them. And then there were the fireside chats. You just played the first one. I think he sounded a little nervous, actually, compared to the audios that I heard of the next 27 over a period of 12 years. He was always nervous before he began them, but he got into a better radio rhythm. And this was, as you say, radio networks were proliferating, households with radios were exploding exponentially, and he had an extraordinary reach. People thought, I mean, my parents told me, he was on the radio every week all the time, just 28 in 12 years. With a huge impact. And Kennedy does it again with television. You played an Eisenhower news conference, the first televised news conference, and he was clearly not happy. He said, we'll see if this is a disturbing influence, not exactly welcome and glad to have you. But JFK was a master. I'm old enough, I'm really old enough to remember rushing home from elementary school in the fifth and sixth grade so I could hear the press conference that had been scheduled, because he was fun. He would always pick on one reporter who would ask us kind of a silly off-topic question, and he would bounce off her and just smile, and the place would crack up.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned that. We actually have a clip of President Kennedy getting a question from a reporter at one of his news conferences. Let's take a listen.
Mr. President, the Democratic platform in which you ran for election promises to work for equal rights for women, including equal pay, to wipe out job opportunity discriminations. Now, you have made efforts on behalf of others. What have you done for the women according to the promises of the platform?
Well, I'm sure we haven't done enough, and... I must say, I am a strong believer in equal pay for equal work, and I think that we ought to do better than we're doing, and I'm glad that you reminded me of it.
So there you have it, President Kennedy sort of having a fairly cordial, at least in some of those televised news conferences, relationship with the press.
But that's the very woman I was referring to, May Craig. She was really a groundbreaker, and she had started in the Roosevelt era as one of only two women in these crowded daily, twice a week press conferences. And FDR gave her a hard time. He teased her a lot. By the Kennedy years, she was pretty elderly. She wore a flower pot hat on her head and made her easy for JFK to spot. And he knew when a press conference was dragging a little, he would call on her and really just had to smile in response. And that was a great example. But she did it almost every time there was a press conference. He'd find a way to call on May Craig, who was a great veteran, but also asked just delightfully loopy questions. And that wasn't such a loopy question, by the way.
Yeah, yeah.
It shows you how far we've come. But it sounded exactly loopy in 1961, I promise.
It sounds right in keeping with what you'd ask about today. You know,
yeah,
we've exactly only got a few minutes left in our conversation, unfortunately, so I'm going to speed ahead a little bit and go past Nixon and Watergate, which is obviously dealt with in your book and obviously is a turning point, the sort of celebrification, you know, Woodward and Bernstein right, being played by Redford and Hoffman. But let's jump ahead to, you know, people today talk about a sort of Trump derangement syndrome among members of the media, and that there's something right about the president that's maybe a little out of proportion to what he's doing and saying that lead them to treat every utterance as a major scandal. And I want to come to that idea, but you also talk in the book about Bill Clinton and his relationship to the press, and he had this effect on some reporters. Can you talk about that parallel there?
Well, it is an interesting parallel. I'm not even sure I quite make it as directly as you did. I could not really find a rationale for reporters conducting the kind of obsessive scrutiny of Bill Clinton that they did. And Clinton is the one president that I interviewed for the book. He at this point feels they were doing their job. He's not bitter, except when it comes to Travelgate and Vincent Foster. That he will always be bitter about, because he feels they were irrational, without substance, and in the Foster case, a calumny against someone he cared about and Hillary cared about deeply, and I don't think he'll ever get over that, and I'm not sure he should. But there was a derangement syndrome. Joe Klein, the reporter who was the anonymous at that time writer of the novelization of Clinton's escapades called Primary Colors, later said that he thought the only reason was we had all misbehaved in the 60s and most of us got caught, and we all resented the fact that Clinton misbehaved and he never got caught. So we were determined to catch him, which is a pretty feeble reason for subjecting a new president who, I think, mishandled the press from day one. He did not have the right press secretary. He and Mrs. Clinton ordered that the door be shut between the press room and the press secretary's office, driving Helen Thomas into a rage, by the way, which is not a good way to start. So there was a derangement syndrome. And whether there is about Trump, I think Clinton never called journalists the enemies of the people. He called them enemies of the Clintons. Maybe he said there was he and Hillary said there was a vast right-wing conspiracy among some. But I think the level of rhetoric that Donald Trump has imposed on this long-existing, not competition so much as tension, necessary tension between journalists and presidents is over the top now. And I think, in a way, the derangement is justified, but the derangement just leads to more derangement on the other side of the presidential rostrum. So it's pretty unhealthy at the moment. But as I say, and I said in an op-ed piece last week, I said, you know, there is if it's important enough to people that the press have an ability to make inquiries without being labeled traitors, they have an opportunity to address that concern along with what other concerns they have on November 3rd, or by mail, as I said. So we'll see. As Donald Trump says at every press conference, we'll see what happens.
The book is The Presidents Versus the Press, The Endless Battle Between the White House and the Media, From the Founding Fathers to Fake News. Harold Holzer, I'm looking forward to the sequel, to getting some of that good Cleveland and Garfield gossip in there.
You may be the only one, Brian. That's your training at the Journal Register, I think.
Thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you for having me. Take care.
And that is all the time we have. The 21st is produced by Anna Casey and Ryan Wild. Eunice Alpesan's our engagement producer, and our intern is Zainab Qureshi. Technical direction and engineering comes from Jason Croft and Steve Mork. Reginald Hardwick is our news director. The 21st is a production of Illinois Public Media. I'm Brian Mackey. Thanks for listening, and we'll talk to you tomorrow.